This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A new study suggests there's a link between a toxin called BMAA and neurological symptoms like those seen in Alzheimer's or ALS. That's of interest to people in our area because BMAA is sometimes found in blue-green algae, the same algae that often clogs bays and beaches on Lake Champlain and other local water bodies. Health officials track these algae blooms and have advised people for years to stay out of them when they occur. They can cause skin rashes and stomach problems. And dogs that have spent time swimming in and drinking algae-choked water have died. And questions have been raised before about a possible connection to neurological problems associated with cyanobacteria, the more technical name for blue-green algae. But this new study is the first animal study to show a connection between this toxin and these neurological issues. Today on the show, we're going to look at the study and discuss how it relates to work being done in Vermont. We'll also look at the gaps that still remain in our understanding, and we'll talk about what the environmental community is thinking about for future cleanup. We're joined now by Dr. Elijah Stommel, a neurologist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, who's worked extensively with ALS patients and who's been looking at connections between the disease and blue-green algae. Dr. Stommel, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Good morning, or good afternoon, rather.
We're also joined today by Chris Killian, Vermont Director of the Conservation Law Foundation. Hi, Chris. Nice to talk with you again.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Stommel, I want to start with you. This was not a study that you were involved in, but can you summarize what the study entailed and what it found?
So the study involved feeding vervets, a small mammal, BMAA, which is a toxin that's been associated with neurodegeneration, specifically ALS, Parkinson's dementia complex, in Guam back in the 1940s and 1950s when there was a real epidemic of ALS and a Parkinsonian syndrome and a dementing syndrome that looked like Alzheimer's on that island. And epidemiologists there were able to study what the people were eating there, and they found this toxic amino acid called BMAA in cycad plants, which the natives were eating. And the BMAA apparently comes from cyanobacteria from the roots of the plant, of the cycad plant, and they have a symbiotic relationship. So all these neurodegenerative diseases probably have some genetic predisposition, but also some environmental risk factor that may trigger disease over time. And we mapped out our ALS patients many years ago now and have continuously done so over the last several years, and we found clustering of ALS around certain water bodies, and those water bodies, by and large, have cyanobacterial blooms in the summertime. And we found evidence of BMAA in fish and in aerosol samples from various water bodies that contain these cyanobacterial blooms. So we're trying to make a link between this toxin that has a history of going back to Guam and what we're seeing in northern New England.
Let me just ask you to clarify what exactly BMAA is. You mentioned that it's an amino acid protein. It's not the only toxin that's found in blue-green algae, right? And it's found in other things as well.
Blue-green algae produce probably over 100 different toxins, one of which is called microcystin, a liver toxin which can be very toxic to humans and to domestic animals or wild animals. That's a well-known toxin that we should worry about. BMAA is a non-biologic amino acid, so it's an amino acid that we don't normally incorporate into our proteins, but the translational process in cells is such that BMAA can fool the system and get into proteins, and when it does that, it makes them misfold. And when the proteins misfold, it can be neurotoxic and kill neurons.
And so in this study that just came out, these vervets were given BMAA, and they all developed these neurological symptoms. Is that right?
They used a high dose, a low dose. They used a blocker of BMAA, L-serine, which is the amino acid that BMAA substitutes for. And then they had a control group. And they were able to produce through histology, not through symptoms or findings on neurological exam, but simply the histology, they're able to show neurodegeneration that looked identical to that of Guam. So when they did postmortem studies on brains from patients in Guam, they saw a certain type of neuropathology. It looks very similar to what the vervet monkey model shows. And it also looks very similar to Alzheimer's disease.
I want to invite our listeners into this conversation and ask you what questions you have about what studies have shown about the connection between cyanobacteria, this blue-green algae, and neurological issues in humans. We're looking at what a new study tells us and also thinking about the important dots that are yet to be connected. And if you have a question that you would like answered or at least considered, no promise of answers here because a lot is still unknown, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Chris Killian is also with us with the Conservation Law Foundation. Chris, what was your reaction when you read this study's results?
Well, we've been following this research for a number of years and waiting anxiously for the outcome of this study. We knew the study was underway. We knew its general characteristics, the characteristics and design of the study. And it's, in a way, it's a very important breakthrough that we've all been waiting for on this connection between BMAA and neurodegenerative diseases. I would point to the last sentence of the study itself, which says, "This study indicates that chronic exposure to BMAA can trigger neurodegenerative illness." That's very important because people that live near, use, eat fish from, recreate on waters that have these cyanobacteria blooms like Lake Carmi or Missisquoi Bay or Shelburne Pond, St. Albans Bay need to know that not only are there many other toxins that are of concern, liver and neurotoxins, but there's this emerging link between Alzheimer's, ALS, and exposure to BMAA. This is an issue we're working on in waters throughout New England, and it's an issue globally that as cyanobacteria outbreaks become more prevalent, a lot of interest internationally in this topic as well.
What's already being done in the state to warn people, as you said, of the known dangers and these potential connections to human health and cyanobacteria?
I think the Department of Health has been taking this very seriously, and not just the BMAA issue, but exposure to microcystin, which Dr. Stommel mentioned earlier, even skin rashes, those sorts of things. But my concern is that with the outcome of this most recent study, there was also a very important literature review funded by the National Science Foundation and the Chinese Academy of Science that was published last year, that recommends, the study literally says, a guilty until proven innocent approach to management and public health response to these harmful algae blooms. We are concerned that the message that we've heard, just stay away if you see a bloom, is not sufficient when it comes to the types of risks that we're seeing emerging here.
We got a note from Mike Winslow, who's staff scientist for the Lake Champlain Committee, who says, in looking through a number of Alzheimer's-related websites, including the Alzheimer's Association, the National Institute on Aging, the Mayo Clinic, and WebMD, they identify lifestyle risk factors for Alzheimer's that include high blood pressure, diabetes, and high cholesterol, but none mention exposure to blue-green algae. Based on the research, how strong of a causal factor is exposure to blue-green algae relative to these other well-known risk factors? Dr. Stommel?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Neurodegeneration, specifically ALS and perhaps Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, probably require more than one hit or more than one insult. So it might be that at an early age, you're exposed to cigarette smoke, and then a little bit later you have radon in your basement, or you have high blood pressure, or some other potential risk factor, maybe cyanobacterial toxins, in this case BMAA. And then over time, you develop neurodegeneration. Certainly, genetic makeup is important. So not everybody who's going to be living on a water body with blooms is going to come down with neurodegeneration. At least we don't think so. And So, and the same thing holds with smoking. Not everybody that smokes cigarettes is going to end up with lung cancer. But if you have the right sequence of hits or the right exposures, you might very well end up with a disease.
So to Mike's question, do you think something like that should be listed on websites that talk about potential risk factors?
I think it's probably too early to put it on the list of potential risk factors for neurodegeneration. I think the animal model is fascinating, and you know, there aren't very many examples in the literature of toxins producing neurodegeneration in animal models. There's a few cases in Parkinson's disease that have been well established. But this is really the first one that shows evidence of neurodegeneration that looks like Alzheimer's or potentially what happened in Guam.
Our number, if you have a question about what you're hearing, we're looking at the connection between blue-green algae blooms and neurological problems in humans. Our number again, 1-800-639-2211, or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Victor calling in from Concord. Hi, Victor. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm an open water swimmer. We have a Northeast Kingdom Open Water Swimming Association. Most of the lakes we swim in, just about all of them, are pretty cold in the summer. And I can't remember in the last 5 years swimming through any algae. But, you know, when you have people training who are going to be in the water for hours at a time doing 10, 15 miles, isn't it worth it at this point, based on what you're saying, for a warning to go out so we don't do it if there's a blue-green algae, if there's that much of a risk factor?
Victor, thanks for the call. Chris Killian, what do you think?
Well, I can just say personally, based on what I know about this research now, that I will not personally boat on, fish in, or enter in any way, or even interact with some of these places, these water bodies that I have loved over many years because of this, and I won't let my kids do it.
You mean at all, or just when there are known algae blooms?
Certainly when there are obvious algae blooms. One of the things that is now coming to light in the literature as we understand it is that particularly with regard to some of the other toxins, microcystin in particular, there actually is often a spike in microcystin concentrations in the water at the time of die-off of the algae outbreak. And that can persist after we see the algae in the water. There are so many good reasons why we should be cleaning up the sources of phosphorus pollution that are fueling these outbreaks. I don't think you'll find a lot of folks arguing that the condition in St. Albans Bay or Missisquoi Bay or Lake Carmi or where any of these blooms occur, the lower Charles River in Massachusetts, another example, is okay. We need to be aggressively dealing with the problem. But this link to neurodegenerative diseases and this emerging research really puts a lot more urgency from my perspective behind those efforts. We can't be telling communities that are suffering with these outbreaks, people that live along them, people that want to use beaches, you're going to have to live with this for 10, 15, 20, 50 years, which are some of the statements we're hearing from regulators and others about what it's going to take to clean up these outbreaks at the current pace. So it really is just very strong additional information increasing the urgency to deal with these problems and get them cleaned up and letting the public know. People have a right to know about this research and to ask questions about it and make their own decisions.
Dr. Stommel, while we're talking about the research, can I ask you what you know so far or what is known about how somebody would get this toxin, BMAA, into their system? I mean, if we're talking about this is sometimes in algae blooms, sometimes found in other things, and you were talking about how this was ALS was found in people in Guam, and it can be found in the diet of people, and it was fed to the vervets. How would somebody in a more natural setting have exposure to this toxin?
So we have an elaborate questionnaire that we give out to ALS patients and to controls. And not all of the clusters that we've identified have patients who are necessarily recreating in the water or eating fish out of the lakes or getting their water directly out of the lake and then showering in the water. But we have been interested in the aerosol exposure, and that research that we've been doing is starting to show evidence that if you are near a water body, and especially downwind of that water body, you may be breathing in cyanobacteria. Jim Haney from UNH and our group here at Dartmouth have been looking at this carefully, and we have identified cyanobacteria in the lungs of several high-risk patients who lived on water bodies. So I think aerosol is one thing to worry about. Certain foods, certain fish, shellfish are filter feeders. They filter as much as 7 liters of water an hour. And in southern France, there has been identified some ALS clusters. And those clusters are near shellfish production areas where those shellfish have very high levels of BMAA.
Has BMAA been found in postmortem examinations in people who may not have lived anywhere near a water body? I mean, is this found in other in people who don't have exposure to cyanobacteria?
Generally, the control brains where we don't think there's any evidence of neurodegeneration have shown lower or no levels of BMAA.
No, but I don't mean that. I mean people who are getting neurological symptoms or who have Alzheimer's or ALS. But are there patients who you're finding who have BMAA and have had these symptoms but have not had exposure to water bodies in the same way that the clusters that you've studied in Vermont have?
I don't think that's really known. There were some studies. One was done in Miami where they did find BMAA in several ALS patients' brains. But they didn't look to see whether they were exposed to water, per se.
Again, today we're talking about what's known and what's still to be researched about the connection blue-green algae blooms could have to neurological problems in humans. Hearing from some of you with questions, we'll get to more of your questions and comments coming up. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're also going to talk more about what kinds of mitigation Chris Killian at the Conservation Law Foundation would like to see in terms of pollution cleanup. And we're going to talk with the health department about how they're looking at this. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Dr. Elijah Stommel is a neurologist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. Chris Killian is the Vermont director of the Conservation Law Foundation. Together, they're helping us understand what studies have shown about the potential effect of a toxin in blue-green algae. If you have a question about the studies or what kind of work might come next in research or conservation, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And I'd like to turn now to the Vermont Department of Health. We're joined by Sarah Vos, who's the state toxicologist. Hi, Sarah. Nice to talk with you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Have you looked at this study? What do you think?
Yes, we have. This study does contribute to the body of research on BMAA, and it's very good to see the researchers moving in the direction of an animal model, in this case monkeys, to understand the toxicity of BMAA. But more research is needed on this topic because this study doesn't provide the type of conclusive information to definitely link BMAA to neurodegenerative diseases. Again, it adds to the body of research, and that's very important.
Why doesn't it draw a conclusive line for you?
So these monkeys did not actually go on to develop any clinical symptoms, and perhaps those studies could be extended a little bit more to try to observe some of those clinical symptoms.
So it was just looking at the brains of these monkeys, you mean, and not what symptoms they developed?
That's correct, yes. And in regards to BMAA, the types of species of cyanobacteria, that our Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation has found in Lake Champlain, those were not considered BMAA producers according to a literature study in 2015. There aren't that many labs that test for BMAA, but we would like to see some more testing done on some of the cyanobacteria samples from Lake Champlain to see if BMAA is indeed found in any of our cyanobacteria.
So we don't know, but through testing, whether BMAA is present in the blue-green algae that's found in Lake Champlain and other water bodies.
That's correct.
So when you say you'd like to see that, is that something the health department could either do or compel?
So the types of labs that are best suited to test for BMAA are usually not within health departments. We would definitely be interested in having some of those samples tested by the labs that are able to test for it, though.
Dr. Stommel mentioned ALS clusters that he's recorded and studied near water bodies in Vermont. Is the health department following those clusters or doing anything about it in agreement with Dr. Stommel?
So we have read those studies. They are somewhat epidemiologically weak. There are many known risk factors for ALS, and those include things like exposure to heavy metals, pesticides, tobacco use, and age. And the studies don't always account for those and the other risk factors that could have contributed to those ALS cases that were found by the researchers. And also in at least one study, when the researchers looked, they did not find any BMAA in the water of the lake where their study was conducted.
So we heard from earlier from a swimmer and from others who are worried about what they're hearing and reading, not just about BMAA, but about other toxins that are found in cyanobacteria and other health effects on humans and on animals. What do you think needs to be done to inform and educate people who are living and recreating in Vermont bodies of water?
Every summer we do quite a bit of outreach as the summer season comes along and people start getting out into the water. And we encourage everyone to check our map. It's at healthvermont.gov. We map the current conditions in regards to cyanobacteria blooms so that people can look at the map, which is updated almost in real time, to see where cyanobacteria blooms are present in the Vermont lakes. And our message to the public is that if you see a cyanobacteria bloom, to stay out of it. That's the best way that we can help ensure the public's health is by preventing contact to the cyanobacteria.
Given the alarm bells that have been raised and the studies that are being done and the connections that are being drawn, is this something that's a priority for the health department?
Our blue-green algae monitoring program is definitely a priority. Last summer, we were one of the only states in the country to offer testing of public drinking water for the common cyanotoxins that are found here in Lake Champlain. We tested all 22 of the drinking water supplies, and no toxins were found in that finished drinking water.
That's Sarah Vos. She's the state toxicologist at the Vermont Department of Health. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Killian, I'm going to come to you in a few moments to talk more about what should be done next in terms of cleanup, what concrete steps you'd like to see. But Dr. Stommel, I'd like to ask you for a response to what Sarah Vos was saying about the health department's concerns that some of the clusters that you've been researching aren't what they would necessarily determine or define as a cluster of ALS.
Yeah, I can address that. I mean, a lot of that is work in progress. You write a paper and then you try to get more data, and we are trying to look at all risk factors that we think are important for ALS and map them out for New Hampshire and Vermont, and we're actually in the process of doing that and have funding to do that. The other questions that Sarah Vos addressed, when we see ALS patients in clinic, they may have very few symptoms, yet half of their motor neurons are gone already, and that's well documented. And there are people walking around who develop ALS who already have histological changes in their brain. I know that from my own experience. And that we have found BMAA in lakes in northern New England, not specifically in Lake Champlain, but we have found BMAA in Lake Muskoma, which is one of our major paradigms for this whole study.
So you think this is a concern for people here and for lakes in our region that do have blue-green algae blooms?
Well, I'm not trying to, you know, ring any alarm bells. What I'm trying to do is science.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that it is a concern because of this recent paper that came out. And There's been literature before that paper that suggests that BMAA can cause neurodegeneration. But this is a very strong paper. The fact that the monkeys aren't showing signs of neurodegeneration clinically really doesn't mean very much.
Let's go to Jared, who's on the line with us from Burlington. Hi, Jared. Go right ahead. Jared, you there? Oh, it looks like we lost Jared. We have a couple of emails that I'd like to read. Alan says, this seems like a great opportunity for UVM, St. Michael's, et cetera, to do some research. What are the BMAA levels in drinking water at different times of the year in towns that source their water from Lake Champlain? If it is in our water, can it be removed by treatment or filtration? What are BMAA levels in the air around the lake at various locations, distances, and weather connections? Alan says, if the connection between BMAA and neurodegenerative diseases is further substantiated and significant levels are shown to exist here, it would dramatically change the equation for cleaning up the lake. And Wolfganger says the scourge of algae can be eliminated in 4 months flat with the manufacture and installation of waste converters that dewater cow manure and convert it to useful byproduct components for resale to commodity users and for feedstock into other industrial compounds. The manure itself made dry is easily burned in industrial boilers. So both of these commenters looking at ways to clean up the lake, more research needed and more to be done quickly. Chris Killian, what do you think needs to be done?
Well, again, I would start by going back to the published literature review last year by Oregon State University in North Carolina, funded by the National Science Foundation and the Chinese Academy of Sciences. They looked at this issue. The literature review was international, and they recommend, quote, a guilty until proven innocent approach to harmful algae bloom management consistent with the precautionary principle in order to safeguard public health from both known and unknown cyanobacterial risks. There are so many reasons that we need to be accelerating cleanup of Lake Champlain in these problem areas. We know from the literature I've learned from talking with Dr. Cox, the lead researcher on the paper published last week, as well as Dr. Stommel, that BMAA bioaccumulates in the food chain. So people that are eating fish out of these lakes, out of Lake Champlain, need to know what's happening and whether BMAA is present. The research on aerosol exposure, people that are breathing this stuff is advancing, and we need to know more, certainly, but it's of great concern. You think about populations like the city of St. Albans, people that live on St. Albans Bay, that live on Lake Carmi, in many cases have had places of residence, often for summer recreation, for decades. Another great example is the Charles River in Massachusetts, where we have the Esplanade and the Boston Pops and the Sailing Center. These are real risks that people have a right to know about, and we need real response both in terms of data collection, lab analysis. We need to know. And I hope the state does embrace the notion that we should be monitoring for BMAA and documenting the BMAA emissions or presence or absence in the harmful algae blooms that we have here in Vermont. Based on what we understand, I think it would be highly unlikely that none of the cyanobacteria strains in Vermont emit BMAA. That would be a quite remarkable outcome, but certainly we need to know. But fundamentally, we need to shorten the timeframes and get much more real about putting real resources and money into cleaning up the sources of phosphorus that are causing this problem in these lakes. Stormwater runoff, agriculture, and wastewater treatment facilities are the big three contributing to Lake Champlain's problems and often elsewhere. And we're just nowhere near the level of activity and funding that we need to get this lake clean in a time frame that is right to protect Vermonters.
Let's hear from Cree calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Cree. Go ahead.
Hi. I just need some clarification. Sarah Vose, our state epidemiologist, said that, you know, practice caution if blooms are present, stay away from them. And yet I heard from Chris Killian that at the time of die-off, there's a spike in concentration of toxins. And so you can have a high concentration and apparently clear water. So I just need to have a clarification here about the danger here.
Cree, thanks for the call. Chris, can you help clarify?
I would almost ask Dr. Stommel to weigh in. I know his focus is on ALS and BMAA cyanobacteria connections, but
it just points out how difficult it is to get a clear cut answer. And it's been well documented that all of these toxins, be it a liver toxin or a neurotoxin, are not produced all the time. So you might miss them if you only measure at one time. We're not looking at the food chain in any kind of a really systematic way. Yes, you could potentially have clear water, or the blooms could be underwater so that you wouldn't actually see them. It's a very difficult notion to get to wrap your mind around and to figure out how to measure things properly.
Yeah, and Cree, I mean, I'm sure that's going to sound even more alarming. So we'll try to do some research on our end, and if we find anything conclusive, we'll put it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or on our Facebook page. Dr. Stommel, is there anything that this research does or the new study shows that could help you treat patients with ALS, Alzheimer's, or other neurologically degenerative conditions?
Well, one part of the study was to try to inhibit the BMAA with L-serine, and they did show a reduction in neurodegeneration in that group of animals. And a phase one trial, a safety trial, has been tried with L-serine. It was on a very small group of patients for ALS. And I think a large phase two trial would be very interesting to see. There might be a subgroup of patients that have their ALS on the basis of exposure to BMAA, and it's possible that the L-serine might reduce the levels of BMAA over time through protein turnover. So that would be one important study. And, of course, now you have a good animal model, and you can test that animal model with various drugs, with various hypothetical blockers, and see if you can reverse the disease that's present histopathologically.
That's Dr. Elijah Stommel. He's a neurologist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Chris Killian is Vermont Director of the Conservation Law Foundation. Thanks very much to both of you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, is Iowa really flat? And what do Iowans think of Vermonters? Those and more informative questions answered from our team of crack reporters just back from their trip to the Hawkeye State. That's next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermonters have been following the Democratic presidential primary campaign with particular interest. Whether you're an ardent supporter of Senator Bernie Sanders or recoiling at the prospect of him winning the nomination, it's safe to say that Vermonters have more than a casual interest in the outcome of next Monday's Iowa caucuses. VPR sent a team of three reporters to Iowa for a firsthand look at what the Democratic race looks like in that state. We also solicited your questions about the Iowa caucuses, and our team has a lot of answers for you. So I'm going to hand it over now to VPR's Peter Hirschfeld, Taylor Dobbs, and Patty Daniels for a reporter's notebook of sorts on what they observed and learned in Iowa.
Okay, guys, this is Patty.
This is Taylor.
And this is Pete, and we're going to start with the basics. We got similar questions from Lisa on Facebook, Kirsten on Twitter, and Marianne via email, and someone on Reddit as well. They all ask, what exactly is a caucus? What even happens at a caucus? And how does a person get to attend a caucus? Patty, why don't you take a stab at it? How do the Democrats caucus in Iowa?
Right. And the Democrats do this differently than the Republicans do. Any legal voter can participate in a caucus. There is same-day registration. You choose your party when you register and walk in. Each candidate is going to have a representative at your local neighborhood precinct, and they're going to make a case on behalf of that candidate. There's no secret ballot. You literally have to stand in the corner of your preferred candidate. And then they do a quick count. And if one candidate doesn't have a 15% threshold of support, then all the people who were in that corner get to choose a new candidate to go to. So there's about a half an hour. The supporters of the remaining candidates get to argue and make their case. And then after that, when the votes are counted, the delegates that come out of that precinct are allocated to the remaining candidates based on the percentage of support they got in the room in that precinct.
That's not the end of it, though, Patty.
No, there are a few more layers of bureaucracy to go through in the Iowa Democratic Party. Delegates will then meet at the county convention, and then coming out of the county convention, there are more delegates that are assigned to the state convention, and then coming out of the state convention, there are delegates assigned to the National Democratic Convention this year in Philadelphia, who will ultimately cast Iowa's votes for their preferred presidential candidate. And some things can change at each level of that voting, but right now what everyone is focused on is what will individual Iowans have to say when they show up at their neighborhood caucus precinct on Monday night. Now, if you're a visual learner, please go to vpr.net. We have an amazing video that will explain to you in 2 minutes with Legos exactly how a caucus works.
And we got another listener question from Jackie and a similar question from Nathan, and that's, what information sources are Iowans using to make their decisions? What media outlets? Is it print, radio, TV, internet, social media? Pete, you asked people about this. What'd you find out?
So all of those media are in the mix. I'm going to cop here to being a little bit of an AM talk radio junkie, and I can assure you that an enormous portion of the local programming in Iowa right now is dedicated to hashing out the details of the primary. The big difference for folks here, though, is their direct access to candidates. People told us they have a very high expectation not just to see the candidates speak, but also to hear detailed speeches and question and answers with audience members. People are not satisfied with a short rally.
All right. We also got a question from Beatrice, who asks, I would like to hear from young people or any age people who don't vote. Why do they think that's okay? So I spoke with a couple young women in Waterloo, Iowa, who told me why they don't caucus.
I think most people don't do it. They don't have time, you know, or maybe they don't feel there's a candidate that they feel strongly enough about to do it for.
Okay. This is how I feel. I work second shift. I have no time for anything but work. So when I get home and look at CNN and HLN, that's my time to catch up on what's going on. So I really don't have time. So
we do vote, though. We do go out because our opinion does matter. We do vote, and we do hope there's a change.
And I thought that was interesting because she was emphasizing the difference between voting in the general election but showing up to caucus in what would be a primary for her state.
But it is true that relatively small portion of eligible voters in Iowa show up to caucus. In most years, it's around 20%, and that's according to the Iowa Caucus Project at Drake University. But 2008 was a little bit different because Iowans were apparently really psyched about Barack Obama, and nearly 40% of eligible caucus-goers participated then. So that was a big increase. And that year, it was also a 5% increase among young voters, according to the Pew Research Center. And those young voters overwhelmingly supported Obama over Hillary Clinton. But that makes the question this time, with Bernie Sanders polling really well among young voters, will they turn out again on caucus night for him?
And Pete, you reported a story this week that looks at the intersection of youth voters and women voters. What did you hear from Democrats about the draw of supporting a woman as the party's presidential candidate?
It's definitely weighing on their decision. We heard this over and over again. But I want you to listen to one caucus goer. She's a nurse named Jean Ross. She also happens to be the president of National Nurses United, which is a 185,000 member union that was among the first to endorse Bernie Sanders. She traveled from her home in Minnesota to be in Iowa to campaign for Bernie Sanders.
I will tell you that as a profession of mostly female, we are bitterly disappointed that it can't be Hillary. We would so, so like to see the first female president. And if Hillary were a Bernie in female form, we'd be right with her.
Now, that's just one voice, but she does represent a demographic that both the Clinton and Sanders campaigns are keeping really close tabs on right now. Taylor, a few Vermonters asked, and I think everybody wants to know, why Iowa? Why is Iowa the first in this primary process?
Well, the short answer is that the electoral process that Patty was describing earlier takes a really long time. And because there's so many steps before the national convention, it needs a long lead time. So the caucuses have to happen early. And that's the historical reason. But now a lot of Iowans are just really proud, and it's sort of a prestige thing, and they're trying to protect that. One Vermont listener wrote us that Iowa is an obscure place with a ridiculous voting process, And I heard from a guy named Glenn Smith in Atlantic, Iowa, and here's what he had to say about that.
It's a very enviable position, and the attention it brings to Iowa, it's a little bit of a heady responsibility, but we appreciate that status. And I think Iowans as a group, well-educated, engaged, probably are very well-suited to that role, that first-in-the-nation role.
And so there's this fascinating contradiction where you see these relatively low turnout numbers in terms of the percentage of Iowans that are actually showing up for the caucuses, but the folks that do go to caucus take it very seriously.
That's what I observed as well, that if the turnout may be low, but those people who are turning out, because the process is so rigorous, they're really dedicated to it, and they tend to be extremely high-information voters.
So a few notes on geography, just to kind of try to help everybody get situated in Iowa. It's more or less of a rectangle with the Missouri River on the west and the Mississippi River on the east. Des Moines is the state capital, and it's roughly in the center of the state. The western half of Iowa tends to be conservative and Republican. The northwestern region has a strong base of evangelical Christians, and eastern Iowa leans liberal and Democratic.
But before we headed to Iowa, we got this from Carl in Putney, who said, "I grew up in Iowa and then moved here to Vermont. My first trip back to Iowa, I was amazed at how flat it was and how little my Vermont depth perception was worth there. Please use extra care when driving around, especially when passing on two-lane roads." Very kind of you, Carl, to be thinking of us.
Yeah, that wasn't a question, but we really appreciate the sentiment. We made it. We drove more than 2,000 miles while we were there. There was so much driving to get all over the state, but we had no accidents and no tickets that we know of. There were speed cameras. But we didn't think it was quite as flat as Carl said. There's tons of open sky, but there's also rolling hills kind of all over the state. And I actually took a time-lapse video of one of my drives west out of Des Moines so that people could see how it is.
David asked on Facebook, "I would want to know whether Iowans have an image of Vermonters which benefits or hinders Bernie."
Okay, I will say that Iowans think very seldomly about Vermont is the impression I got. I asked a lot of people this, and I usually got a raised eyebrow like, don't really know anything about Vermont. I guess the message there is get over yourselves, Vermonters. People aren't really so focused on us everywhere else. Taylor, we also asked the flip side of that question to Iowans, though. What image do you want Vermonters to have about your state of Iowa?
And we definitely found out that Iowa nice is a thing. You know, they always say people are really nice in the Midwest, and we actually heard that Iowa steps it up a notch. And that was kind of our finding as well. We had one cab driver who said that Iowa is the Canada of the Midwest, and everyone is really friendly here. And here's Selma Pepik, who we met at a Hillary Clinton rally in Iowa City, talking about that.
Iowa is a place where you come and just do your own thing. People in Iowa are just so welcoming to everybody, and we have so many different ethnicities and so many backgrounds, and we're not about corn and all that kind of stuff. Yes, we do have it, but that's not what it's all about.
So people there really love where they're at, and I think a lot of Vermonters could relate to that.
Final question, and this one comes from our coworker, VPR's own Leslie Blount. She asks, does the caucus become a holiday-like celebration? Do businesses take advantage of all these people needing to be somewhere at 7 p.m. and offer early bird dinner specials, post-caucus parties?
Okay, I love the idea of a post-caucus party. I refuse to believe they don't exist, but no one I talked to fessed up to throwing them. Here is a more prosaic description of caucus night from Ann Selzer of West Des Moines.
For me, the fun of caucus night, it's sort of driving down the street at about 6:30 and you see the garage doors all opening as people decide, okay, here I come. I'm going to go caucus. And there's a little bit of, you feel the ground pulsing a little bit. It's an exciting time. No doubt about it.
I also talked to a Des Moines resident who told me that he actually hops around town that night to watch the cascade of concession speeches one by one. And he describes this and his coworker standing next to him saying like, man, you are a caucus junkie. I don't know that that's so normal, but there is definitely an enthusiasm and electricity on caucus night in Iowa. So guys, final impressions from whirlwind trip to Iowa.
Iowa nice, I will attest to, really is a thing. Iowans were so friendly to us, so accommodating, and really very thoughtful, with very few exceptions. Everybody that I approached was happy to offer their insights and their perspective on the race and anything else I wanted to talk about, frankly. They're fiercely proud of Iowa, and it was a real pleasure to be out there.
I was really struck by, we were talking about a poll as we were getting there, that Iowans are mostly optimistic. And we were kind of confused by that, being that they're in the center of the presidential campaign and things get a little bit rough on the campaign trail. But after being there, I totally get it, because people really, whatever their views are, they really want what's best for this country. So I left kind of feeling optimistic myself.
Yeah, I think that was my impression too, Taylor. You may not like the way that they choose on Monday night, but it won't have been arrived at casually. You know, it's a weird process, but I can also see that it's a great example of democracy being a participator sport.
And of course, the question everybody wants the answer to, but one we can't give you yet, is who's going to actually win this thing? If you stay tuned to VPR Live on Monday night, February 1st, we'll have the answer for you then.
That was VPR's Peter Hirschfeld, also Taylor Dobbs and Patty Daniels, all reflecting on their reporting trip to Iowa and answering your questions about the caucuses that will be held there on Monday. They mentioned an animated video with Legos of how the Democratic caucuses work in Iowa. You should definitely check that out. It's at VPR.net, where you can follow all of VPR's campaign reporting. And be sure to tune in tomorrow when Bob Kinzel will host an Iowa preview with retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis and Norwich professor Megan Remmel. That's on this show tomorrow, live at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.